allow people just to accomplish less, to spend less money developing than they initially committed to. But if they can do it in a manner that probably is more efficient, they've discovered a different approach than we envisioned, and that it looks like it's going to work, and they're basically accomplishing the goals of the developer, then our position would be that we probably ought to let them do that. It gets back to the guy who built a barn for 500 cows instead of four barns for 120 cows.
Go ahead, Mr. Schultz.
Just, do you know of any other state that has this kind of conditions put on land?
Yes, many of them.
Ag rights only, that's the way they state themselves.
There have been many different attempts to accomplish the same thing. One of them has been to limit the title. In others, they enter into long-term tax agreements. That doesn't work in our state because our land taxes aren't significant at this point anyway. It's occurred very much like this in places like New Jersey, where they've entered into title modifications and are in fact in the process of buying up development rights from farmers who have an unconditional fee something.
A little bit different, though, talking about buying up from people that have fee simple title that own the land. I just really have a problem with the whole thing. This is a far cry from what I would like to see before us. As far as the fee simple title, I don't believe, in my opinion, that the state should ever dispose of one square inch of property unless it's fee simple title. And if that piece of property is the best interest of that person and making a buck down the road or whatever it is, if it's putting a condominium on it or whatever, or putting a flagpole on it, that's what they should do. I just have a hard time tying up the land ag rights only. I have a hard time. That's not the way the United States of America was settled. That's not the way that the communities and the landowners around the country settled in areas.
Conditions have changed. The Constitution of this country, in its infinite wisdom, initially said that black people and Indian people only had 3/5 of the vote. We've decided that might have been okay in 1780, but it isn't okay now. The history of the last 50 years in this country has been a continuous and relentless change of title and of normal ownership rights in an effort to make more sense out of land patterns. And this is what we are trying to do.
Let me ask you a question here just to sort of get in the middle of this a little bit. Give us an example of a recent ag sale.
Right here.
And how much was paid per acre for the conditional title?
I'm going to defer to Frank.
Verse.
In the land selling business.
What, maybe you could even speculate, I guess I wouldn't hold you to this, but what would have that land sold for if it hadn't been conditional to on its title? I'm trying to figure out whether or not people could afford to buy the land to farm if it was without a condition.
Mr. Chairman, we generally figured that ag rights are about 20% of the fee value, but there's a wide variation in that. The higher your land value goes in its fee simple state, the lower the ratio will be. For example, Point McKenzie, the land was sold at $100 an acre, and its fee value was probably closer to $2,000. In Delta, right now, there isn't a big deal of difference. It's more like $85 an acre, say 160 acre tract, $85 an acre for ag rights, and $350 an acre for fee simple. And that's pretty much the same, say, in the North Pole area. So, but we, just as a general rough rule, it's about 20%.
Mr. Sutter,
just a question along the line. If the auction that was held on some of the 2,000 acre tracts of land, I believe that some of that land sold for $150 to $200 an acre auction, and those were 2,000 acre tracts of land. That land itself, as you well know, on the market today, fee simple title wouldn't bring $200 an acre.
Representative Schultz, that's correct. People did bid it up. I think the average for the Delta 2 was over $200 an acre. What people were buying into, though, were the loans and the 6% interest and the clearing loans, the ability to pay yourself and all that. Now that that money is no longer available, the value is no longer, it's a fraction of that.
and I guess the question that many of us had at the same time that that sale came up, or those kinds of sales, it would have been better off to put a fee simple title, sell it, sink or swim. You know, state back away from them. Say we have an ag division, we're sitting here, we're looking at markets and things of this nature, and you don't put all of these things in place, ag rights only, and then set up all this structure of how you go about getting loans, and the stubble's got to be 4 inches high, and on and on and on. It just
hindsight is great.
Yeah, that's the problem here. That was then.
I think we've learned from that process how to do an ag sale. Canon Autoloop, which is up in your area, has been an extremely successful sale, but we took a very different approach. What we did there, in essence, was instead of having all the development requirements spelled out in detail, we said, here it is, it's going to be a fee simple with a conditional agricultural title. You don't have to develop anything. If, however, you want to put up capital improvements, clear the land and put up agriculture buildings on it, we will give you a credit toward the purchase price. Otherwise, you're going to pay very high, essentially, normal value for that land. Now, you make the choice. You buy it. It's a farm project. But if you just want to sit on it and pay full price, that's fine. If you want to develop it into a farm, you will end up being more like what agricultural rights are worth. That worked extremely well. We've got more than 90% patents issued on the last sale unit.
Representative Schultz, the purchase price in that sale was very high, partly because it's the first major land sale the state dealt in many years, but those prices averaged over 300, some as high as 500 an acre, which was higher than the prevailing rate for non-agricultural land in the area.
The tracks were smaller, too.
Probably we should get more land out to the people and might solve some of these economic problems we're having in the rail belt area.
Be simple.
Yeah, that's correct.
Correct. Be simple title. All.
Mr. Hoffman?
I have a couple of questions going back to the legislation. In the original piece of legislation, in Section 6, you're talking about, under the definition of agricultural purposes, you're talking on line 12, you're saying that the construction of the residence of the grantee or leasee. But in the revised version, you're excluding the leasee, and I was wondering if that, why you were doing that, and then, I wonder what you could, what are the differences in section 2? One, you call for a different repealer, and I wonder why. What are those two repealers, and why are you changing the sections?
Okay, can we get some staff here to give us the sites here? It's 05321A in the original bill, and 05020B7 in the substitute. And the substitute is a rewrite, basically, isn't it? That's why you're repealing 020B7, because that is rewritten.
Mr. Chairman, 020B7 currently restricts the ability of the commissioner to make changes in development plans. In other words, right now the commissioner can make changes to make a very limited case.
Okay, so you eliminate that and put in a new way for them to change development plans. What about 321A, 05321A? Did somebody have that cited?
What's that?
That's the general definition of agricultural rights.
Okay.
And why, the first part of the question, why... In one section, in the first bill, line 12, you have or leasee, and then in the second, the revised proposed legislation, that is eliminated.
But Mr. Chairman, if you go back to the original language of the bill, we were lifting all ag rights. I mean, we were lifting a two-fee title. It said, in the sale and disposal of state land classified agricultural land, you shall be restricted as provided under this section. The commissioner shall convey a fee simple conditional title to the surface rights. We were, you know, with a condition subsequent, but what we were doing is we were allowing the commissioner to be able to modify that. And under your repealer here, your repealer took out, as they're saying, that took out repealed the ag rights only issue. The one under your bill, under the bill that's before you, repealing is the commissioner may waive or postpone if it's inaccessible by road or if the market development cost too big.
Well, my question is, why are we changing the definition of agricultural purposes? In one bill, you're including leasee, and in the other bill, you're excluding the leasee. And that seems to be a major change in the whole intent of the legislation when you're changing the definition of what agricultural purposes are.
That's correct. But you see, the thing is that, Mr. Chairman, what we did was that this whole bill changed, and what we did is that we took away, we made the bill, when it came out of the committee, it was to modify, it was to help the farmers in their conditions, and not into the title. It was the condition, as I recall, that we changed so that it gave relief to the people that were locked into certain provisions within their contracts to be able to go to the commissioner and get them modified.
Well, the way that I would see this is that if the under the new bill, if the grantee wanted to get out of the definition of agricultural purposes, he would assign it to a leasee, and that leasee would not be obligated to comply with the agricultural purpose, the definition of agricultural purpose, unless the leasee is included in the definition.
Mr. Director, you want to comment? Apparently, the question centering around the original bill on line 12 included the words or lessee, and the substitute doesn't have that word in there.
What happened there was that the inclusion of the word lessee in that section made it read like lessees could build farm residences. And it was an oversight originally. When somebody got looking at it and thinking about it, suddenly we realized that we didn't want to be in the position of suggesting that if you leased a parcel, you could then go out and build a home on it. That gets us back into the duck shack problem that was popular last year. We decided we'd better avoid that problem, and that's the, as far as I remember, that's the only reason that was taken out, because we didn't want to encourage people to build residences when they were only leasing.
See,
I don't think it was designed to change the definition of agricultural purposes.
Mr. Hoffman appears to want to make sure that there's not a loophole there. That,
right.
That somebody could become a lessee and as a result not be under the same requirements.
Yeah, I don't read this as changing the definition of agricultural purposes to exclude lessees. They would be bound by exactly the same provision
language.
Yeah, right. I'm just looking at the old definition of ag rights here now. 321A.
Under the committee substitute, the section 321 would still apply to all agricultural land, whether it's leased, permitted, sold, cashed out, contract, whatever. 321 still applies to everything.
Right. Oh, that's what I see. That's what the senator wasn't able to get through the Senate. Try to repeal it. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I would have a question of just a mechanical question. 3805059, unless it's different in the supplemental, is a one sentence, three line section of which we're repealing and reenacting into two pages, and the original language in the statute isn't included in any of the language in this bill. I don't.
Repeal.
Right.
I mean, mechanically, you'd create a new section and just repeal 059. That's in effect what you've done.
That's what you're doing, I believe. Can you say that?
Yeah. Why are we doing away with the limitation that's in existing 059? A person may purchase from the state a total of not more than one parcel of land that is part of an agricultural development project under 475 during any 8-year period.
This puts me on friendlier terms with Representative Schultz, I think. Our position there was that we didn't think that the state should be limiting what people can do. If we're going to create
Mr. Sun's question is more on the drafting style here. Shouldn't have you had another repealer for 059 and just created a new section? This doesn't appear to really replace that other section at this point.
Normally, when we say repealed and reenacted, it means you took a section and you kind of, the amendments you're making to it are so convoluted that you rewrite the section. In this case, what you've done is repealed 059 in its entirety because it doesn't even show up, no portion of it shows up in this bill. And you put in another issue here. I think you ought to pick another section number and put the repealer in, and that would probably clarify it for everybody.
I now remember what happened. I think that there were several versions of this, and the first ones of them had some of that original language in there. And as we worked on it, it got deleted, and probably we didn't go back and realize that we had worked ourselves into a drafting problem with the format.
But your actual goal was to repeal 059. And
we didn't start out that. I think Senator Coggill will agree. We didn't start out that way, but that's kind of where we ended up together.
His original bill did that.
Yep.
Did it.
Anyway, that's a technical question. We can take care of that.
Of course, if that had stayed on track, Mr. Chairman, with my original bill, why then it would have made sense.
His original bill had the language in it, though.
Yeah, had parts of it.
I see, of course. Yeah. Did you have something else there, Mr. Sun? I think there was one other person that had signed up to testify on this bill, and then we're going to get back to the rest of the time until 10 o'clock. Mr. Weaver was going to discuss a few other things, but
I'll wait.
I don't think we're going to move this morning. I think that they have, you have some proposed amendments from the department?
We have some intent language that we'd just like to make sure what the intent is.
Okay.
It is necessary. We don't believe
I have 30.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Can we just have the other, did you want to testify this morning, sir? You can give us your name for the record here, please.
My name is Harry Watson. I'm from Point McKenzie. I'm Chaffee. My wife and I are trying to carry on now. We, along with several of the other farmers, have certain problems of counting that are affected, partly by this bill. One of them is that every time that you want to put up housing, you do a dairy farm as a business. And you have people that work on the business, and there's 100 and presumably possibly 700 people that could be working out there, and some of them have to live there. And it's very helpful to be able to borrow money to construct residences for them to live in. And that's one of the things, and I think you were going, but I'm not a lawyer, and I don't know what some of these things are. But to be able to borrow to construct a home or a residence or to put up maybe a mobile home trailer on a piece of land, whether it's 5 acres or 20 acres, it's very important to be able to do that so that you can have people who work at this business on dairy farm. I have a second problem, and that is in the course of our particular route through the Point McKenzie project, there were some things we didn't quite anticipate. In fact, it was not possible to know Director Weaver said, what the depths of the soil were, or what the depths of the water were, or which way the wind blew, or what the floodplains were, if anything, and flood effects might be. But we know a lot more now than we did 5 or 6 years ago. And there are some things that are quite evident. We can't properly meet some of the requirements for confining, for example, waste material on site and handling this without having appropriate lagoons and appropriate ways of doing it. We know how to do that now, but this is a very time-consuming thing, and we want to protect this area, which is surrounded by wetlands. I don't know if you have a map of this. This is about a dozen miles from Anchorage across the neck arm of the Cook Inlet. And it is a 15,000-acre tract more or less surrounded by wetlands and small lakes and salmon streams and this sort of thing. And it is very important not to adversely affect this area, which is used for tourists and for fishing and all sorts of things. It's embedded in the Susitna Flats game refuge, and it takes some degree of care to preserve it. Now, back to our problem. Perhaps all by myself, alone out there, I have some 35 years in the physical sciences. I grew up on a farm in Michigan. I have some 20 years of farming experience in some various things. And there is a period in my life that I've worked as a general physicist that I learned a lot of things. I learned about groundwater. I learned about environmental hazards. And I learned about these things that could be problems there. And I worked more or less constantly on the water and wind problems. And I waited on our particular site and planned so that we could burn off try to clear the thing properly and not have unnecessary wind breaks. And to do that, you have to know how the wind blows. And to do that, you have to find out how it does fall. And therefore, it takes time to do that. And this is one of the things that you have when you have deadlines that don't, you know, they don't know exactly what happens. You put deadlines in there, and as you try to achieve something, you're going to run into a conflict with these deadlines. And this is a thing which I think you ought really to be aware of in terms of this deadline bit and what the commissioner does. Now, what happened to us and to many girls out there is that we are restricted from doing a proper job on clearing because we can't burn off some of the things that have to be removed. And we can't. We could not. We didn't know the best ways of handling some of these on-site things, and we have put a lagoon on and have our thing properly done. And I've learned a lot from my neighbors in this regard. But there are problems, and some of these problems involve the lakes and the other things that are very important. And if time is not taken to do it right and to protect these things, there are big problems in store. And in our particular case, we were delayed by a number of these things from getting our stuff done. And there is a thing which happened to be out there. There was a very sharp increase in the number of cows with a desire to get milk into production at a state-owned facility, a Madison-made dairy, to get the cows into production so that it could operate profitably. And then the market kind of went down on that, and it couldn't apparently market it quite so well. And there's a lot of problems in running a dairy production facility, and the state is, I think, very widely, I think they could be commended for getting some of the farmers and producers to help them, because that's really one group, the producers and this milk marketing thing. The market is something you have to go to the people with. And this is one of the things that we could, I think that we are handling about 25% of the milk, and we could easily, handle 50 or 75% of the
amount.
This could be done.
Could I get you to try to get back and focus on the bill that's in front of us here this morning? We sure appreciate that.
So, on these conditions that relate to the bill, I would like very much if, in our case, we are one fact which has been prevented from going into production because we did not have cows on site. And the reason we did not have cows on site is that we could not. We thought we had a one-month extension, and for some reason that was repudiated as being in violation of this. But we could not get our cows and get into production. Had we done so, though, it would have been a very severe impact on the market. I mean, they might very well have had to dump an additional $500,000 of milk in 1 year. And,
so do you think that? Do you think that you were prevented from getting the loan you needed for those cows because somebody felt that that would result in too much milk being produced?
I don't know. They didn't discuss this with me. They brought up questions about environmental conservation. We had the loan. The loan was in the office in Palmer, and for some reason they couldn't find it. We just never did get a hold of it, of that money. We had the cows sitting about 5 miles away, and they were prevented from going into operation.
Well, how do you think this bill will handle your situation? It gives quite a bit more flexibility to the division. If you can make a showing that you had one of the three problems listed there, they could modify the conditions. And one of the conditions, of course, would be what time of the year you showed up with your cows. So that it sounds like you're testifying in favor of the bill.
Yes, I'm testifying in favor of the bill. And one of the conditions, such as number two on the second page, fourth or fifth line from the top, that might very well fit it.
Yeah.
I'm not a lawyer, I don't know.
Yeah. Okay, well, are there questions? We appreciate your testimony, sir. We've got about another 25 minutes. I'd ask Mr. Weaver to join us back at the table here. And he said he had about 5 minutes of things he wanted to present to the committee and then make himself available for questions about activities that his department has jurisdiction over.
Mr. Chairman, if it's acceptable to you and to the committee, I thought I would take a brief look at what the agriculture industry looks like in the state and throw it open for questions. I had some comments on what we're doing inside the division, but I anticipate a very brief presentation by me. The farmers and nursery and greenhouse operators in the state are in the business of replacing imports. We have virtually no export markets. There may be a few, but they're relatively small. We do, however, do a better job at replacing imports than most people have given us credit for. We're turning out about $35 million worth of product per year. In the last 5 years, agricultural products have substituted for about $150 million worth of imports. What's a little interesting on this chart is where the big numbers are. Nursery and greenhouse operators are accounting right now for the lion's share of production. And if you expand the nursery and greenhouse to include the intensively managed horticultural crops, which would be vegetables and potatoes, you see potatoes over here and vegetables here, you've got about 60% of the agricultural production in that one sector of the industry. And that sector is relatively prosperous. These are primarily people who, if they have loans, and many of them do, they're paying their loans. They're not delinquent. They have thrived really without any big bursts of project activity, such as we experimented with at Delta and Fort McKenzie. The other major impact on this is the milk producers. We have at Point McKenzie 8 farms that are producing. In addition, there are several farms, older farms in the Matanuska Valley. There are also three producing farmers in the Delta area. The value of that milk raw is about $6 billion. After processing, it's up around 12 million.
It's appropriate to have the processing in red.
The red. I could have used black.
For a couple of reasons.
We were $20,000 ahead last month. And the reason for that is kind of interesting. The largest firm in Seattle doesn't make it to three different states. And the major retailers, Target and Safeway, were hurting for milk.
They were.
So it's not that it can't be done. It can be done. We have a marketing problem. We need to consistently turn out a quality product, which we are now beginning to do. And we need to branch out, I think. An interesting little development 2 months ago was that we came online with yogurt. That was the first time we produced yogurt. The yogurt not only took off in the stores, I forget, it's something over 100,000 cartons of yogurt the first month, but the price of yogurt from other companies dropped 10% instantly in an effort to keep pace, and it didn't keep pace. People call me up and say, why aren't Matt-made products competitive? And the answer is that they are competitive. If they weren't out there, price of what people pay for milk products would be much higher than this.
Do you sell as much milk as you produce? I mean, is there a problem with marketing the milk that you do produce?
That's been an on and off problem that began about a year ago. What happened was that the population started shrinking in the state. We all know that. The size of the market for milk shrank with it. And as that happened, although our milk production wasn't increasing significantly, we began to have a surplus that we hadn't done a good job of anticipating. What we started up was a series of
relatively small advertising campaigns, and those seem to be paying off, and we started aggressively turning that milk into other products. That seems to be paying off. We didn't have surplus milk last month.
Now, the state still owns the old Matt Maid Creamery, right?
The creamery was acquired from producers in 1985.
So now you're in charge of that facility then? I mean,
the facility is owned by the loan board for the Agricultural Revolving Loan Fund. It is managed by somebody who is on contract to the loan board. Decisions that are made about the creamery tend to be joint decisions. The department may take a position, the loan board may take a position, and we are usually able to work out any differences so that we come to some agreement. The laws relating to the loan fund suggest that policy decisions really belong to the department. Decisions affecting particular assets, financial decisions, really belong to the loan board. And we've got a situation here where there are both policy implications and financial implications, obviously, and so we've been trying to work together, and I think successfully. But right now, we are in the process of encouraging all local milk producers who use the Matt Maid Creamery to devise a board of directors and basically take over the management oversight of the creamery with our assistance. We were supposed to have started that the 1st of January. They had some difficulty putting together their bylaws and articles of incorporation. As of yesterday, I'm told that they seem to be just about through that process, so we should have a new board in place within the next month.
A new board. So they would replace the Ag Revolving Loan Fund Board?
They would essentially replace the Loan Fund Board, but financially they are still responsible to the board ultimately. But in practice, the management of the creamery would be done by the plant manager, subject to review by the new board of directors.
All right, now when they came and talked to me, they also talked about a potential ownership situation.
They want to own it. I think in principle that's a good idea. I'm nervous. I'll tell you why I'm nervous, is that producers owned it in 1984 when it went bankrupt, and we can't afford to do it twice. So I think we've got some new people involved, and I think there's nothing in principle wrong with producers having the major stake in the creamery. But I want to give them time to develop a sophisticated organization. You know, what they may have learned in 1984 was that if you trust the plant manager to call everything by himself, you can get burned. That's what happened in the early 80s. And by the time they discovered it, it was too late to do anything about it. I would simply like to see a transitional phase where we can keep an eye on it and make sure that they develop the board structure and the sophistication necessary to keep this thing going.
I just want to note for the record that I'm very impressed with your answers here.
Thank you. Well,
no,
I love it.
Yeah, I think most people would like to see the state. You know, I get a lot of mail from people that complain about things in general, and one of the ones that's often easy to pick up is, why is the state in the dairy business or in the creamery business? And so it sounds like it's a goal of yours to move that, but to do it intelligently.
We want to get out of it because I am convinced. You know, this figure tells me that the dairy industry in this state is very valuable. This figure can not only probably double, because we're only picking up about 25% of the market right now. Over the next 5 years, we could easily get 50. But we don't need the state running this. On the other hand, just dumping it into the producer's hands right now is probably not the best thing to do. I'd like to see a smooth transition, and that's what we're working for. I think they can run it. I think we need to give them a little time to learn how to run it. And at that point, I think we've got a good investment. Right now, it's still shaky. Some other things up here that may be worth noting. Our Delta project, I think, should have been viewed as an experiment. What tells me that is that we've only got about $1 million worth of grain being produced right now. The reason for that is that we don't have an export market. Delta was conceived as an export project, and the in-state
need for grain is not much bigger than what's up here. We had it to do over again, I suppose we'd do a different one. But I don't expect this to change for it in the near future. Our grain future right now looks gloomy. There's certainly enough action out there for half a dozen good producers, but there's not going to be 80,000 acres in production in Delta in the foreseeable future. This figure is interesting. The meat is not really significant, a little over $1 million worth. But there's a reason for that. The only major meat plant in the state, which was privately run by Donatello and Palm, basically went out of business. We had the major notes on it. We acquired it as a result of the foreclosure. Again, a loan fund asset. That plant, after opening up for the first time in quite a while last spring, began to influence meat production pretty significantly. The quality of meat has gone up and the volume is rebounding. If that plant stays open, being run by Prison Industries as it is, and if it gets that meat into the wholesale markets, in other words, sells it so that people as well as prisoners can eat it, we could see this figure take off. We're producing less than 5% of our in-state meat right now. If we got that figure up to 50%, which is probably a reasonable target based on what vegetables are going to be, we could see this figure really climb. And I think it could easily be as significant as our milk production. People have, we've gotten some bad press on the meat plant because newspapers seem to be convinced that it's losing money. Losing money is really an accounting problem. They've got to warehouse those prisoners that are working out there anyway. They've got to give them some kind of rehabilitation and vocational training. If you charge all that off against meat, they might be losing money. The figures actually show that if they go ahead and get into the wholesale market, which they recently decided to do, they're probably going to make money, not lose it.
Sure.
And the rehabilitation comes free.
Do you have to import certain meat products to be competitive?
No. The plant itself,
yeah,
you're talking about? No.
Pork and stuff like that?
They did import pork because what happened when the plant closed, when it was privately owned and it closed, producers didn't have anywhere to go with the product. So they started killing off their stock and not replacing it. When the plant opened, there was a lag time. Right now, producers are beginning to crank up again, but that initial six-month period was kind of grim because there was a shortage of animals. So they went out and bought some hogs from Canada to fill the gap. We've got a lot of complaints about that, but the bottom line was that corrections didn't have anywhere to get the animals from. They had to do something. So I would expect that to be a one-time thing. It's not likely to happen again. This has potential to be a real economic bright spot. It's just that we're not there yet.
So what's happening now? There are people raising hogs and cattle in the Palmer area. They bring them down to the...
In Delta? So, and on the Kenai.
But they're transported here, and then it's processed. And then what happens to the product?
Well, it was set up so that all that product basically got turned into either pork chops or hamburger and fed prisoners. That was a relatively limited market. What's happened
it's
is...
growing market.
Growth industry. Prime with the growth industry. What's happened is that the prices that they set to the guy who was growing beef or pigs were Nebraska prices, which are relatively low by Alaska standards. Nonetheless, there are a lot of people who are willing to raise beef and even pigs who don't need much profit. They're willing to produce them even though they're not putting much in their wallet. And they've started to crank up production beyond anything that was anticipated. Corrections is now responding to that, I think, wisely by saying, we want to do more than just feed prisoners. Why can't we put this into a wholesaler so we'll turn around and move it to Cars and Safeway and whatever meat shops are on the corner and get it out to the public? They've decided to do that. There were some challenges to it. I think they're going to work those out. And if they do that, we've got a significant market opening up. And it's economically very efficient. We are doing it for I see this little industry poised for possible venture, but there's the linchpin, the bottleneck right now is that meat plant. I'm convinced that it's probably a good thing for the state to keep that meat plant open in terms of dollars and cents return to the state for good investment. And if we don't run it, nobody else will. Meat plants, privately held, are one run typically on a 1% profit margin, and they make it only because they're dealing in places like Chicago in huge volume. We don't have that kind of volume. When Donatello ran that plant, I frankly think that if anybody was going to make it work, he would have, and he was unable to do it. And I don't think we can expect the private sector to do it.
What's the major difference between your ability to be successful and his inability?
Prison industry is running it. They don't have the wage problem. Their costs, they do have to look after prisoners, but they have to do that anyway. Their costs are not significantly greater running meat plants than they are housing those people in prison.
So it's labor, basically.
It's labor, and it's, we've got a plant there that's probably bigger than it should be. It's there, we might as well use it, but if we had to design it over again, we could have made it smaller. It was designed when we were looking at the Delta project and we were counting up pigs and cows and sheep on paper, and we had numbers that looked like they were never going to stop. Those were pretty unrealistic numbers, and that plant was built with the expectation that those numbers were going to become real, and they haven't. And they won't. Not with our population.
We've got about another 10 minutes. I don't know if there are other questions. You're sure welcome to discuss other legislation that we might expect to see in this committee the remainder of this session, or whatever else you have on your mind.
I thought I, if you're interested, I could talk briefly about what sort of strategy I'm trying to apply to what the Division of Agriculture does and how we relate to the lot of questions about that recently. Some thought that maybe we could do without an agriculture division. I would rather, if there are questions, before I get into that, I would rather take the questions.
Are there many areas around that like deal in hydroponics for, you know, growing agriculture products?
There are none that I know of. The closest we might get would be some of the geothermally heated greenhouses that occur in the interior, but that's not really hydroponic grown.
Would you recommend?
Hydroponics?
Yeah.
I think there's some recent breakthroughs in hydroponics that are very interesting, where they're using not large bodies of water inside greenhouses, but mists that spray the roots of plants without any soil at all. Very low water volumes and very high production. Probably we could do something like that. We have perhaps the most ideal greenhouse climate for 6 months of the year in the entire North American continent. Because the principal problem in greenhouses is lack of light, which we have in abundance. The second major problem is, believe it or not, cooling greenhouses, not heating them, but cooling them. And our air temperatures are very favorable for greenhouse production. So greenhouses and experimentation with hydroponic methods is something that can really pay off. We could probably feed our state out of greenhouses.
Hmm. What about are you expecting major changes as far as your operation as a result of this year's budget? For instance, is the Plant Material Center in Palmer going to remain in operation approximately the same as it is now?
Let's see, there's a party line I have to stick to here, so I'll try to stick to it. We're attempting to keep a maintenance budget. That means that the Plant Material Center won't cease to exist. My own sense is that I'm worried that over the long term we're going to starve it to death. You can cut back and you can cut back, and we have been cut back in the last 3 years pretty severely. What the Plant Material Center does is provide a very important link between university-type research and farmers, and university-type research and the oil industry and the mining industry, who need revegetation materials for their projects. When you research projects that we do are relatively short term, but their benefits are still spread out over years. And when you start starving research, you can end up down the road bankrupt. I think we've done a pretty successful job of reassessing our priorities, trying to make sure that we're doing things that directly benefit either the big resource industries through their revegetation needs, or those industries that appear to be prospering and in need of our help, the greenhouse and horticulture sectors in particular.
I remember
about what happens 5 years from now.
Well, I remember something happened a few years ago, and that was an appropriation for another plant material center up north someplace, and I think there was an acquisition of some property, and that, to my knowledge, never was constructed.
That's correct.
What's the status of the, are there dollars that have been appropriated that are in limbo?
Well, that appropriation was, the money's out of there, I believe, were reappropriated. Last year, there was $3,000 left.
How much?
A few. Oh. It was less than 30. I can't give you the exact figure.
What about the land? Still on the land or no?
I believe we still own the land. That was that whole capital project was a very long-term prospect. I mean, it was designed to acquire some pretty basic, as opposed to applied, data about what happens in the far north. It was built on permafrost. It was in an area where data might be very important 50 years from now, 100 years from now, but it wasn't going to be immediately applicable. I think when the budget started deteriorating, decisions were made that, you know, that kind of project might be nice, but maybe bringing home the bacon was more important in the near future. I think the last little bit of that money was reappropriated last year, and we saved something like $5,000 so we could make sure that what we had done to the permafrost wasn't going to cause a mudslide onto the East Highway. There was some concern that we had created an unstable situation. The
last report I got, however, was that that was pretty well under control and that the permit process seemed to be still frozen and not in danger of developing into a mudslide.
I'm afraid we're about out of time. We've got a caucus at 10 o'clock, so unless if you had some remarks you'd like to leave us with, you still have a minute or so.
I guess my one comment would be this. I'm dedicated to the idea that inside the Division of Agriculture, we should be people who know about farming and have expertise in agriculture that is important to Alaska. I'm aggressively going after new people where we need them, but to replace old people. And I'm trying to get the people who are already there to work together and share information and data with each other, share expertise. I think that is something that is important in the long run. One of the proposals that came out of the House last year was to consider dispersing agricultural services to other departments. The major loss that I see there is that when that happens, you lose the ability to have a center of expertise in an agriculture, in agricultural-related fields. I think we're on the right track in making that division a source of expertise, and I would like to think that if we can be of help to you in commenting on anything related to agriculture, or on what we've learned from our experiments in Delta and McQuaid McKenzie, terms of land use and agricultural development, that you would be willing to call us for help.
Thank you very much, sir. Anything else? We're adjourned. Oh, by the way, you said you had some recommended language for letter of intent on this. Could you make sure our staff has that and Senator Coghill's staff?
I'd like to call the House Resources Committee meeting to order. Today's February 4th. Members in attendance are Representative Cotton, Herman, and Sun. Sorry for the delay today. We couldn't get enough committee members here, but some are on the way. Last year, we held many hearings on the subject of mariculture, which we have before us today. We put a lot of information on the table, and hopefully committee members have had some opportunity to read some of the information on mariculture. And at the end of last session, as we all know, the moratorium bill was passed, declaring a moratorium on finfish until July 1st, 1988. Also, a working group was formed of legislators, agency people, and interested parties. And the House met with interested parties and had some goals in mind, and later met with the Senate. And as we know, the Senate had different views on how to proceed. Anyway, like I said earlier, we have a bunch of information on the table. Both Senator Eliason's office and mine, we posed questions before the state asking that the state come back with some answers on these questions. And that leads us into what we'll be talking about today, an update on what the state has been doing, giving us some answers to some of our questions, hopefully, mentioning some of the remaining questions, concerns that need to be addressed, updating us on the shellfish progress, and we'll hear from Commerce on their application, and I believe they have a preliminary study done. And we'll go through what we can today, and I'd like, you know, probably them to come back tomorrow because hopefully we'll have a fuller committee. So with that, I'll ask the lead agency group, the Fish and Game was designated as lead agency with Commissioner Collinsworth as the lead person, and he designated Dave Benton. And I believe that they all the state agencies want to come up before us and make a presentation.
My name is David Benton. I'm a special assistant with the Department of Fish and Game, Commissioner Collinsworth. What I'd like to do is just provide a little overview of what we all did, and then let each one of the agencies summarize a little bit of what they did, and then open up to any questions that you all might have. As you've already stated, the moratorium bill passed last year. Part of the bill was an authorization for increased shellfish mariculture. And what we did was look at that, sit down with the resource agencies, review the existing permitting structure and process that has been used to date for permitting shellfish mariculture, determine which pieces of that permitting process were working well and which ones were not, and what we needed to do to fix those. That led to, after quite a bit of analysis and work, that led to the Department of Fish and Game promulgating regulations for shellfish farms, and for the three agencies to put together a uniform and consistent permitting process, which involves a sort of a tri-agency application. So the shellfish farmer would only have to fill out one application to get most of the permits that would be needed from the three resource agencies. The second major task that we worked on over the interim was to respond to the questions that the House and Senate posed to us. What we did was look at those questions, confer with staff from both houses, and tried to focus in on what seemed to be the major issues that were, let's say, unresolved or sort of hanging since last session. Those are in a series of issue papers that we put into this report, which we passed out, I believe, not 2 weeks ago. The idea behind the issue papers was to try and frame each one of those issues very concisely and present a discussion that focused the debate around those issues and try to provide the team some information that we felt would be would serve to clarify those issues and try and bring some focus to the debate on mariculture issues. We also researched how four other parts of the world manage mariculture in three states: Maine, California, Washington, and then British Columbia. And in the report is a matrix that we put together that looked at the issues that we identified here in Alaska and how those other areas did or did not deal with those issues. And with that, I'd just sort of go around the table and let each one of the resource agencies present to you a brief summary of what they've done, and we'll open up for some questions. So why don't we start over with DEC?
I'm Doug Donegan. I'm the Director of Environmental Health and Department of Environmental Conservation. What we focused on over the interim is what particular aspects of aquatic farm operations might have an effect on public health or the quality and wholesomeness of products produced in those types of facilities. The main areas that we found for concern were areas where the department may need additional authority to ensure the wholesomeness and quality of these products are some sort of site certification program where we take an initial assessment of what potential sources of pollution may exist at a site, what types of sediment materials may be there in terms of heavy metals, etc. Something similar to what we do with the National Shellfish Sanitation Program for our shellfish growing. Although it would be more limited and there isn't as much danger with finfish and seaweed and other aquatic farm products as there is with shellfish. Another area that we were concerned about and did some investigation is that of chemical usage at these sites. There's a wide variety of chemicals, drugs, antibacterials, fungicides, chemicals of that nature that occur currently use to improve the health and environment of the organisms that they're trying to raise. We believe we need additional authorities to regulate the use of those chemicals so that they are used properly. Quite a few of them have things such as tissue tolerance levels and withdrawal times after the actual application of the chemical before the animal can be slaughtered. FDA and EPA, in many senses, are technically responsible for regulating this. But FDA has one person in all of Alaska, and as they said, the state could probably do a better job in terms of accessibility. DEC is often in the areas for shellfish, for seafood inspection, other duties, where FDA might not be visiting them anywhere near as frequently. And we think control of those types of things is really important to maintaining the Alaska's reputation for quality seafood. One other area that we have not come to any resolution on ourselves, but think it's something that the legislature should probably consider, is the issue of labeling. Currently, there's no requirements that would distinguish a mariculture product from a wild Alaskan product, and there might be some merit or at least an area for some thought that perhaps the legislature would like to have these two types of products separately distinguished so the consumer can actually know where to purchase it. Are there any questions on it?
I might have missed exactly what you had to say there, but would you go back over the part about whether there was more pollution problems with shellfish than with finfish?
There are areas of concern with raising shellfish that would not be as much of a concern with finfish. Shellfish are filter feeders, so there's much more of a tendency for them to bioaccumulate things than there is with finfish.
That's all you had to say on that. That's as much as I know about it now, so maybe there's something else you want to tell me.
Well, what I was trying to say is that with the shellfish program, very extensive certification process. We go to a site, and it's 5 days where we continuously sample the water quality, sample quite a few indicator species for levels of paralytic shellfish poisoning, items that are not as much of a concern with finfish. Finfish, for instance, do not ever accumulate paralytic shellfish poisoning. It is something that's very important and obviously has a consumer impact if anyone ever eats a shellfish that is contaminated. Not a concern with finfish, once again, or seaweed or any other type of mariculture product. Things such as water quality in terms of contamination from waste, human waste, et cetera, is not as critical as it is with shellfish, which accumulate that type of, potentially accumulate human bacterial diseases and then can transmit them.
What about causes of pollution? Is there, would shellfish be more likely to cause pollution, or would finfish be more likely to cause pollution problems?
That question is more relevant to the Division of Environmental Quality. And we look solely at the existing factors that would affect the wholesomeness and public health quality of the product.
Okay. Thank you, Mr.
Yeah, on the shellfish station, Doug, where are we in terms of getting some type of testing lab in Southeast?
We have developed a PSP certification process for private laboratories. The FDA has reviewed that, approved it, and the department is requesting an increment that would allow us the additional monies necessary to travel to these laboratories and certify them for PSP testing.
So in that case, where if you send it to the lab in Palmer now, does the state pay for the cost of the test?
Yes.
And if in a private lab situation, the private grower or whoever that's going to get the test is going to have to pay the private lab. The state's not going to pay
for
those tests.
That's correct.
And are they going to? Is the state going to come up with the testing criteria then?
The testing criteria for
PSP then?
Yes, it would be the same criteria as it is in our Palmer lab. It would just allow local laboratories to do the procedure.
I understand there's some learning process going on with certain shellfish like gooey ducks, or whether you test the viscera, whether you test the body meat to
we're finding with redox extremely high levels of PSP fairly frequently in the visceral ball, but we're also studying tissue samples, and at this point in time, there seems to be very little migration of PSP levels in the visceral ball to the tissue. And, based on the information we're accumulating on that, we're considering maybe dropping the visceral ball testing and just concentrating on the actual animal portion of the animal.
Yeah, I think other jurisdictions have done that. You would be the one who made that decision to what should be tested in, and then the private lab would just follow those criteria?
Yes.
Thank you.
But you mentioned something about chemical usage and needing additional authorities for those chemicals. What chemicals are those? And what?
Well, the Food and Drug Administration authorizes the use of drugs and medicated feeds. And if you would like some examples of that, something there, and anesthetics, things like that. Example would be Romet 30. It's an antibacterial that's used on salmon. It's got a tissue tolerance of 1 part per million and a 6-week withdrawal between application and harvesting. Terramycin is an antibacterial, tolerance of 1 part per million, 21 day withdrawal. Then you've got things that are generally recognized as safe that don't require any oversight, or maybe something like baking soda, which is also used as an anesthetic. Then you have your whole realm of pesticides, algaecides, and herbicides, and they're regulated by the Environmental Protection Agency. And there's 30 or 40 of those in use at present time.
Any other questions?
I'm Amy Cruz. I also work for DEC. I work for the Southeast Regional Office, Division of Environmental Quality. And we spent the time researching two major aspects of mariculture. We have two areas of interest, basically. What type of impact the facilities will have on the water quality, and what existing uses or conflicting uses might have on the product, the mariculture product itself. So we spent our time looking at other systems, Washington State, British Columbia, Maine, California, and seeing how existing systems are regulating mariculture as far as water quality, and what sort of problems they've run into with it. And we're finding that there are two basic areas of concern. One is what the facility, the finfish, will do to the water quality, which is, I believe, your question at some time. And also, what affects conflicting uses, such as a log transfer facility, or as Doug was mentioning, a sewage disposal site would have on the product. We've spent our time estimating these impacts, and it looks, in response to your question, that shellfish very rarely impact the quality of the water around them, whereas finfish would have a much greater impact on the water quality surrounding them. But the key question in controlling any water quality impacts would be the siting of the facilities. And one of our main interests is to make sure that we have guidelines or the review process for the projects will allow us to head off any of these water quality problems by making sure that the sites selected are well flushed and there are no conflicting uses that may cause either a water quality problem or a problem with the product itself. The next area of concern for us would be the control of the discharges either associated with the facility next to it, say log transfer facility, which may create turbidity, which could affect the mariculture facility, or the storage of petroleum products, or, but those are our ongoing concerns with us, and wouldn't be handled in a different way. It's just more of a concern when you've got an edible product that you're going to be working on. We will also be, we have been looking at the way different states and provinces have been monitoring the facilities after they're up and running, and they seem to be doing it on a size-specific way, where the smaller facilities have less stringent criteria, and they also have less stringent monitoring criteria because of the size, which would have a less water quality impact, whereas the bigger facilities would have more of a water quality impact and therefore would be regulated and monitored more closely. We have an ongoing permitting process for facilities which we believe will be adequate to handle fin fish farms. The way we believe we will handle it is to use the existing 401 certification, which is a certification of reasonable assurance for water quality, that the project will maintain the water quality and can be operated to maintain the water quality standards. And we also will, with the department's discretion, be issuing a wastewater permit for primarily finfish facilities that will have a large enough discharge so that under the statutes we will need to regulate it and be concerned with its proper disposal and dispersion.
Just on the wastewater permit, I mean, so you can give us an idea of the category. I think the hatcheries have to get a wastewater permit for the fish species coming out of hatcheries. So I mean, you're saying that a waste permit for plants or projects that would have an adequate amount or a minimal amount of discharge, seems to me that all of them would reach that criteria.
Well, there's a very big difference between the discharge in a shellfish or a plant facility.
Let's just deal with thin fish.
Okay. We would base the wastewater discharge permit on the amount, the quantity of discharge coming out of the facility. So,
can you envision any kind of a thin fish farming facility that would not need a wastewater permit?
No.
So it's a 401 permit and a wastewater permit. Okay. Thank you. I have a whole page full, but I was going to wait until I got through their presentation.
I was asking her, John, not you. In the other countries or states, do they put like the shellfish and finfish sites close together, or do they have them?
Well, there's two ways to look at that. The site specific criteria that each type of mariculture needs limits that to some extent. Finfish need much more flushing, a deeper area.
Mm-hmm.
Shellfish need much more protection, warmer waters, and are more often located near the shore where the phytoplankton blooms are much greater. For example, in Washington State, which has both shellfish and finfish culture, they have a very different system. Most of their tidelands are privately owned, and most of the shellfish are grown right on the tidelands, not from the suspended raft, which is what we've been seeing mostly in Alaska. So they would, by default, not be located next to each other, whereas British Columbia has set distances, established distances, within which no other activity can occur around a mariculture site. So Washington State has chosen not to regulate that directly, whereas BC has established that distance.
Mm-hmm. you know, I know these aren't, you know, firm recommendations, but it looked like you guys were saying that they should be located separately for the flushing reason. Is that?
I'd say that if you located a finfish farm directly downstream or upstream or within the realm of influence of a shellfish farm, you could have problems. But we don't know that distance. It's dependent very much on some specific criteria. And it would be something that we would ask the applicant to establish. In the course of last year's hearings on House Bill 108, lots of concerns were expressed regarding the state's use of, or the use of the state's land and water. And most of those concerns centered around protection of existing uses. So our main task then is to figure out how to encourage the development of tide and submerged lands, which is the charge given us by the Constitution, and at the same time to minimize conflicts with existing uses. I'd like to make a distinction between shellfish and finfish farming here, because shellfish farms are an existing use. Statewide, we've granted some 50 oyster and mussel farm permits out of several thousand permits, tideland permits. And we're not expecting any major increase in the rate of new applications, even with the passage of the Mariculture Bill. But finfish is an unknown for us, and it's clear that the number of tideland applications that we receive is or will be directly related to the kind of legislation that's passed. And to some degree, it'll also be related to when that legislation is passed. If nothing happens for several years, it may be that the world market for net pen reared fish may be saturated and we won't get very many applications. The best way to begin setting up laws for a new industry is to learn from the trials of other states and provinces. BC, for example, after a tremendous land rush, placed a moratorium on finfish farming in order to study its impacts. Some of the recommendations of the inquiry were that the government needs a mariculture policy that clarifies direction, agency roles, and the division of responsibility between the agencies and the applicant. The government should identify sites of high value for other important coastal interests and steer mariculture away from those areas. Local governments should address mariculture within their jurisdictions. Land management agencies should ensure that permit systems include adequate public notice. Right now, we have a 30-day notice. The inquiry recommended 60 days. Commitment bonds and cleanup bonds should be required. The list that we can borrow from other states is extensive, and we think that that's the place to start.
I have one question on that. The tidelands lease, I know the governor recommended that the tidelands be limited to Alaska residents, the leases. Can that be done constitutionally, or?
We don't know if that can be done constitutionally.
I don't think you need to move that.
I'll speak to Fish and Game. What we did, of course, two of the largest issues were last year were disease and genetics, and I think there's still a lot of concern regarding disease and genetics. So our staff did a considerable amount of research and rethinking sort of how that whole issue, what the differences are, say, between the ocean ranching program and the finfish farming operation. And in the issue papers, they sort of discuss the assumptions of those assumptions that they make regarding finfish farming and the ocean ranching program. Our
anthropologists and the geneticists believe that generally if you, if there are prohibitions on importing Atlantics and if there are prohibitions on importing other salmon, so that you're using local stocks, then the disease problem can probably be managed. That assumption is built on having a rigorous program such as what we have for the ocean ranching program. We mean treatment of eggs and fry, we mean very rigorous monitoring requirements. The state having the authority to require the destruction of all stock if they were diseased. That kind of a program. On the egg side, I think that the conclusion from the department is generally the same in that if you apply the same policies that we apply to ocean ranching, such as using local stocks and requiring use of local stocks, then we think that any leakage that might occur out of a pen farming operation could be tolerated. Now, I would put some caveats on part of this, and that is that since we put those issue papers together, we've become aware of that Norway is really starting to experience some problems that, and have some concerns about genetic pollution of their stocks. Our staff right now are trying to track that down and really get a handle on what those concerns mean. So generally, we think that right now that probably we can handle the genetic issue if we have very tight controls on where the broodstock comes from, and that we have the same kinds of requirements that we have for ocean ranching. But if we really do need to sort of look into this these issues that have been raised regarding Norway and the Norwegian finding that up to in some streams that they've got, I guess it's 50% of farmed salmon, or farmed variety salmon in the streams now, and they're setting up gene banks and that kind of thing. I think it's a situation in Alaska probably would not want to find itself in. The other major issue that we identified, it sort of came up last year, and after we thought about it, we think it's an issue that is something the legislature really needs to consider, and that's broodstock allocation.
Okay.
Just on the,
sure.
I wanted to make sure I understood what you said there on genetics.
Okay.
You felt that if you prohibited the Atlantic salmon or other species, that you could handle the disease control, and you could also, if you did those things, you felt that you could manage any problem with genetics, because I assume that means that that way the Atlantic salmon wouldn't somehow pass their genes along to the cohos. Is that what you're saying?
But if you
have the control over the broodstock and you bring in Alaskan cohos and introduce them into a fish farming situation, that you wouldn't be concerned that the genetics would be disturbed or harmed in any way.
If we applied the same kind of policies that we apply to ocean ranching, for example, I think it's 50 miles or some distance such as that, that you take your broodstock within 50 miles of where you are. So that, for example, we don't have a farm down in Ketchikan and we're taking cohos from a genetic stock that's up in Cook Inlet. Okay? We want them to be genetically very similar to the local, the indigenous stock in the area. The one problem that poses, by the way, is that over time, I think that the salmon farming industry will want to generate domesticated stocks, and